One of the great ironies of Sefer Bereishis is the rise of Rivka. I say the rise of Rivka because whereas many of the women in Sefer Bereishis at least play ancillary, secondary roles which fit the sociological expectations and mores of that day, which was very patriarchal, Rivka is much more activist, much more proactive. She's directing much of the action, even though she doesn't have that patriarchal role. She doesn't deliver brachos. It's an irony because she's a foreigner. And, of course, Rachel and Leah are also foreigners, but to a degree, it's a home game for them because Yaakov essentially moves to their turf, into their territory, spends time in their home, whereas Rivka is replanted. And, of course, Chazal's showcasing Rivka's very young age, 3 years old, whatever that means. It's hard to read Tanakh anachronistically. For our purposes, 3 years would be ridiculous, but in the days of Chazal, it had some meaning, but she was still very young, and she was still very mature about it. And yet, she becomes such a proactive she engineers much of what happens, some would call it manipulation, in Sefer Bereishis, of course, in her Parsha. Parsha's told us. Now, what's interesting about it is that despite the fact that she seems, or because of this, the fact that she seems to control so much of the activity, her communication with Yitzchak is never blunt, it's never open. We rarely see them, at least in the text, speaking to each other. In fact, when she has the concerns of these two children who are kicking her stomach and kicking her in the womb, you would think that if she wants some spiritual input, she should ask her husband. And instead, she goes to some unnamed Vatelech Lidroshes Hashem. So she goes to some unnamed house of God to get input that you would think her husband should give her. And I want to talk about some of the Rivka highlights according to the Netziv, because they're separate issues, but together they paint a very, very interesting portrait. Let me see if I can tease out that portrait from two or three different sections. Number one, it starts with Parshas Chayesara. Parshas Chayesara, Rivka meets Yitzchak in the field. He's davening. She sees him from afar. She falls from off of the camel. She's a little bit surprised. Miha Yishalazar Lech Basadeh. She covers herself up. It's really not the way we would script it. We would script it as if Rivka would fall in love with Yitzchak, would be enamored with him, would run, would fall into his arms. Certainly the equivalent happens with Yaakov and Rachel in Parshas Vayetzek. Then one thing is clear, that this is again a younger woman, a younger girl, who is more intimidated. Intimidated maybe is harsh of a word, but she doesn't feel equivalent. She doesn't feel equal to Yitzchak. The Netziv actually uses the word Ome'az Vahala. From that point onwards, Nikba Beliba Pachad. She was a little uncomfortable with this older person, Yitzchak. This more accomplished person, Yitzchak, would undergo on the Akedah. This person who was more paternal. He was certainly older, if we take that Chazal literally, and she was 3 years old. And because of that, her communication, unlike Sarah's communication, which is very blunt, when Sarah has an issue, she's very comfortable speaking her mind to Avram. Kol asher tamar lecha, Sarah shema bekolam. She has an opinion of her own. She doubts Hashem's promise in ways that Hashem is critical of. And of course, Rachel is certainly verbally combative with Yaakov at certain points. Leah less so, but Leah is very proactive in trying to organize Yaakov's sleeping habits and where he should spend time. So Rivka, we think, is much more the word pachad because she's young and because she sees him, because she's in a foreign, not foreign, but she's not at home with her family. And throughout, Parshas told us, they don't really speak. And, of course, they spoke to each other on a day-to-day, but we don't see it. And the Netziv says, Rivka didn't have that ability to share her opinion of Yaakov and Esav. At certain points, the Netziv says that both understood very well who each son was. Not as if Rivka had to set Yitzchak straight, but certainly there was some information that Rivka could have delivered to Yitzchak, didn't deliver to Yitzchak. In fact, in the end of the parsha, when Rivka overhears Esav plotting to murder Yaakov, she quickly demands, pleads with Yaakov to flee. And of course, in that family context, it needs Yitzchak to sign off on it. Rivka camouflages her request. She tells Yitzchak, Yaakov should leave because the local girls really aren't that fitting for our son Yaakov. And she doesn't, even at that later stage where everything had already been settled, doesn't reveal and doesn't have that communication. Now, for the Netziv, this is all Hashgacha Pratis, that Yitzchak and Rivka have a relationship from the get-go that limits their communication, unlike Rachel, unlike Sarah, and that allows for Rivka to engineer the brachos being delivered in a way which is non-direct. For whatever reason, which I won't discuss now, but the brachos need to be delivered to Yaakov in this fashion, where a more natural arc would have been for Rivka to understand whom Yaakov is, and by extension, or by contrast, whom Esav is, correct Yitzchak's appraisal, reverse Yitzchak's decision, and have Yitzchak deliver the brachos directly to Yaakov. But for whatever reason, the Nesiv talks about that separately, the brachos have to be delivered in this fashion. Since they have to be delivered in this fashion, Yitzchak has to be of one mind, Rivka has to be of another mind, Yitzchak has to intend the brachos for Esav, Rivka has to reroute the brachos, and for that to happen, their communication has to be very different and very non-communicative. But even though there's a divine reason for this, it certainly is a very interesting type of a marriage, and it's a marriage that in our own lives, let's say, where we certainly don't have the luxury of assuming that our marriages are predetermined based on Hashgacha Pratis, it's certainly not something we strive for. It's only something we try to repeal, to have healthy communication, to share our feelings, to be of one mind, to see our children in the same light. But on the same token, Rivka is placed into that condition, and there's not much she can do. It's not as if it's her fault that was implanted very deep into that relationship, based on age, based on that first meeting. And it's an interesting part of her relationship with Yitzchak. Now, what's also interesting is her relationship with Yaakov. When Esav and Yaakov are first presented as being, respectively, Yitzchak and Yaakov's favorite, so there's a different way in which Yitzchak's love for Esav is described as opposed to Rivka's love for Yaakov. Torah writes, Vayehav Yitzchak es Esav. Esav is loved by Yitzchak. V'Rivka doesn't say Ahava es Yaakov, loved Yaakov, but Oheves es Yaakov. So first of all, the tense is different. Yitzchak loved, past tense. Rivka, oheves, present tense, continued to love. Second of all, when Yitzchak's love for Esav is described, there's a reason, kitzayed b'shiv, because Esav prepared food for what was presumably at some point an ailing Yitzchak who couldn't provide for himself. Whereas Rivka's love for Yaakov isn't really described as being based on any factor. And in a sense, it's each of these two issues. So that Yitzchak's love for Esav wasn't because of his assessment of his personality or sensing any virtue or traits. It was simply service-based. Yitzchak enjoyed the services of Esav, and he loved him, and he didn't. And that's why the word S as opposed to le. When we describe the love for another Jew, the lamed is employed. You have to le'echa kamocha. Whereas describing the love of Yitzchak for Esav, ve'yehav Yitzchak es Esav. The Netziv at least feels that S is a little bit inferior in this case, although that itself could be argued by comparing other types of Ve'avta Es Hashem Elokecha. But clearly Yitzchak's love was blinded. There's no other way to say this, because Esav served him. And even knowing whom Esav was, he just couldn't escape that gratitude that he had for his son. Rivka had no needs, and because Rivka had no needs, her love was directed at character traits, personality. And the difference is that Yitzchak's love was intermittent, was sporadic. When Esav performed the services and supported his father, the love existed, and then it passed. Whereas Rivka's love was essential and existential, and it grew and it's augmented. And since it wasn't based on any reciprocity or any benefit, it was selfless. And looking aside from the lack of communication between Rivka and Yitzchak, there's an independence to Rivka, which is really what I want to draw out, that you would think that Rivka would have needs and that her needs would supersede Yitzchak's needs and that her love should be more biased than Yitzchak's love. But the irony is that Yitzchak, again, because of his physical limitations, Yitzchak is more dependent, Rivka is more independent, Rivka has the ability to identify personality, Rivka, right? Yitzchak knows the personality, but just his need for Esav serving him supersedes that judgment, creates a love that's not based on essence, but based on service. And ultimately, Rivka achieves a deeper love for her children, a more selfless love, a love that's not based on what a child delivers to you and brings you. So often, in our own parenting, we love our children because of how they affirm our own narratives. They live the lives we believed we could live and didn't live, reaffirm the life choices and the lifestyle choices we've made about ourselves, and want to see our kids reaffirming that. And real and selfless love is when you love someone for whom they are and what their interests are and what their life is, and Rivka demonstrates that. So on the one hand, her relationship with Yitzchak isn't as smooth and harmonious and communicative, and this isn't a relationship of equals, but possibly because of that, she's more independent-minded. I don't know if there's a linkage, the Nisib doesn't link the two, but she's able to see the children for whom they are, not write them into a relationship with her and love them more or less based on how they play into her needs and her interests. So that's, I think, the second profile of Rivka that the Nitziv draws. I think the third profile of Rivka is during her two moments of collaborating with Yaakov. In each instance, both when she and Yaakov have to engineer these brachos, and later when she pleads with Yaakov to flee, so a high degree of collaboration and coordination is necessary. Who will do what? How will the brachos be taken? How will they be served? This is very clandestine intelligence, spying. Rivka's listening to Esav all the time, passing on these messages to Yaakov. Rivka's always hearing and overhearing and surveilling Esav. And at each point, she's very deliberate with Yaakov. She says, Ata b'ni, shma b'koli. Listen to my voice. Shma b'koli. And she repeats the same phraseology twice. Once in the story of Yaakov and the brachos, Yaakov expresses his concern. My brother is more hairy. My smooth skin may give me away, may give me up. V'tomer lo imo, alai ki lascha b'ni ach, shma b'koli. And then later in the section, when she urges Yaakov to flee, and this is not easy for Yaakov. We all know how Vayetze turns out. We all know that he returns. But remember, he's a young person. He's a little bit naive to the ways of the world. Then Avite is exposed by Lavan, who manipulates him. And he's a tent dweller. He's a student. And all of a sudden, he's being forced out into the big world of Aram Naharayim. So Rivka's pleading with him to leave, and she says, V'yata b'ni, shma b'koli, three times, shma b'koli. So first of all, the Nitziv highlights the fact that shma b'koli, throughout Bereishis, especially when imparted by women, always implies Ruach HaKodesh. Kol asher tamari lecha sara, shma b'kola. So Rivka is trying to convince and to allay Yaakov's concerns by generating the confidence that this is a divinely inspired or supernaturally inspired message rather than just... So she's giving Yaakov the confidence. Yaakov is confused. How do I know that these two decisions will ultimately succeed? So she's saying these are both decisions that I'm able to intuit through my Ruach HaKodesh. But it's more than just Rivka counting on Ruach HaKodesh to sway Yaakov. It's Rivka taking responsibility. It's Rivka assuring her confused son that this is the path to take. It's Rivka not imposing parental will, but it's Rivka convincing and persuading through parental example. The Nitziv highlights that when they were busy preparing the food for Yitzchak and hustling around, getting everything in order, so Rivka's involved also. She doesn't just speak. She says, I want you to go get the two goats and kachli misham v'yesel sam matamim li'avicha kasher ahev. So she's involved in cooking. Kachli. So of course the Torah describes her as being the cook. But kachli suggests she was more than just the cook. She was involved. She bore responsibility. So it's not just the Rivka who was able to love her son independently, but it was the Rivka who was able to own a situation, take responsibility, give assurances, generate confidence, convey importance, convince Yaakov, and this repetition of Shema Bekoli, ironically, where she didn't have healthiest or at least direct communication with Yitzchak, her communication with Yaakov is very coordinated, very direct, and very much very sagacious, that she knows that she has to, normally in a relationship we're looking for parity in our communication. And Rivka doesn't have parity. She doesn't feel equivalent to Yitzchak. She doesn't share her feelings with Yitzchak. And when she speaks to Yaakov, she speaks in very direct, I wouldn't say commandeering, but in very direct authoritative terms. And she's able to convince Yaakov during two very delicate moments. So, very interesting profile of Rivka developed by the Nitziv.